Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Gabe Cruz Allen.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with a conversation between correspondent Mark Dunley and Eric LeCompte of Jubilee USA Network regarding the New York Taxpayer and International Debt Crisis Protection Act. Then we hear from two former area coordinators as they discuss their recent firings from Houghton University, and they refuse to remove their pronouns from their email signatures. Later on, Barrio Alegria tells us about creative placemaking and creative placekeeping. After that, we hear from Willie Terry and his coverage of African Liberation Day in that part two of a segment. Finally, Andrea Cunliffe interviews Jean-Remy Monet about his new production called Who Do Love, which is playing at the Capitol Repertory Theater June 1st to 11th. But first, here are the headlines.
The long-awaited departure of Alan Chartok as head of WAMC opens up the opportunity for reforms at the station. Most NPR stations are more committed to a diversity of voices and local coverage and avoid promoting a particular personality. WAMC was controversial within the larger NPR community over its operation, starting with it taking ownership of many local NPR stations.
The Times Union reported that Chartok editorial voice and unquestioned authority over the station drew criticism from inside the Capital Region and elsewhere. In 2011, the ombudsman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting expressed concern that Chartok comported himself more like a WAMC's owner than its manager. It's not his own personal fieldum or station. It belongs to the public, and so do the public radio and television stations, end quote.
The Times Union reported that Kevin Monahan, the Washington County resident accused of shooting and killing a 20-year-old woman after the car she was riding in turned around in his driveway last month, while looking for a friend's house, allegedly told police that he was in bed since 8:30 p.m. and suggested the gunfire could have been the work of hunters.
A report by New York Inspector General Lucy Lang concluded that correction officers are the largest source of workers' compensation relief fraud, accounting for almost half of the fraud cases. The labor agreement provides far more generous benefits for medical leave than other state employees, which the report said created an incentive for fraud.
The Gazette reports that Schenectady Republican mayoral candidate Matt Nelligan is calling on the city to declare a state of emergency pertaining to migrants that are leaving New York City and seeking shelter in upstate counties. Nelligan said that the city should say that hotels and motels should not have contracts to house migrants without city approval.
The Record reports that the Rensselaer County Health Department is renewing a health alert regarding overdoses from a combination of cocaine and fentanyl after a sixth county resident died within the last week. The county also makes the drug Narcan available for free to help with overdose situations. The county has seen more than 40 overdose cases in 2023, a far higher rate than last year. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, listener-supported radio that builds community in Troy and the surrounding Capital Region through broad grassroots participation.
Our content is produced by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to media, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
Opposition from the financial community has begun to mobilize against the push by the Jubilee USA Network for the New York Taxpayer and International Debt Crisis Protection Act. Mr. Eric LeCompte of the Jubilee USA Network discussed this issue with correspondent Mark Dunley.
We're joined today by Eric LeCompte, who is with the Jubilee USA Network. We had Eric on a few weeks ago to talk about the New York Taxpayer and International Debt Crisis Protection Act, basically to provide some protection about third world debt, New York financial lenders. And there's recently been a fair amount of media attention because financial community is beginning to push back. So, Eric, why don't we just quickly start off with, since not everybody probably listened to last week's show, what exactly is Jubilee USA Network, and what is the New York Taxpayer and International Debt Crisis Protection Act?
Yeah, the New York Taxpayer and International Debt Crisis Protection Act is something that's very connected to the history of Jubilee USA. For more than 25 years, Jubilee USA is a coalition of religious groups from the Catholic Church to American Jewish World Service to development groups like Oxfam and Bread for the World to unions like the AFL-CIO and AFSCME. 25 years ago, we all came together as Jubilee USA Network to deal with the strongest structures of poverty and inequality in the world. And at that time, we were very focused on a debt crisis that the world was experiencing. Most countries were paying more on debt over and over again than they were paying on food, social services, healthcare, and education combined. So Pope John Paul II, Christian, Muslim, Jewish religious leaders, the heads of unions came together and said, we need to have debt relief for the poorest countries in the world. And this is happening during the Jubilee that Christian churches were celebrating, 2,000 years since the birth of Christ. So we came together around this idea of debt relief. And that's exactly what the New York Taxpayer and International Debt Crisis Protection Act is about. Because New York is the world's financial capital, it oversees about 52% of the world's private debt contracts. And what the legislation does, because New York can provide debt relief or allow a process that provides debt relief, it says to these predatory groups, they're like payday lenders, vulture funds, that you have to come to the table and negotiate a good deal with everyone else. And if you don't come to the table, then you're going to get the same haircut that others are going to get, so we can restructure the debt back to profitability to protect our pensions.
Now, I actually first encountered the concept of Jubilee when I was an organizer with the Faith and Hunger Network. And Jubilee is actually a concept in the Bible, which is actually the sacred text, not only of Christians, but also Jews and Muslims. And, you know, they understood thousands and thousands a year ago, in order for the economy to actually function, that every 7 by 7 or 50 years, you needed to, you know, forgive debt as a way to sort of reboot the economy to make it more effective. Now, this bill has been moving in the state legislature, and there's been some articles that I read in Times Union, but apparently other places as well, is that the business community has begun to mobilize against it. Where is the bill at this point? Has it made it to any of the committees yet in the state legislature, which only has, I think, about June 8th or June 9th before they depart for their six-month vacation?
That's right. So the reason the business community, and it's not really the business community, because most of the private sector believes in legislation where we can all get together, come to a deal, the best deal for the people and the ones that are holding the debt. But, you know, the Times Union and other papers called it the business community is coming out. And the reason that we're hearing that is because this is the first time that any legislation that deals with global debt crisis, it has passed through committee and is on its way to the floor. in the assembly. So it passed a few weeks ago through the Judiciary Committee. And as soon as that took place, what we saw was that the vulture funds took notice, certain business groups took notice, and they came in to try and kill the legislation. Before, they hadn't really paid much attention because they just thought, oh, this is crazy New Yorkers again doing crazy things. But once it came out of committee, it became real and serious. So we know now that there are some predatory groups, a few other banks that are starting to put millions of dollars into starting to kill this legislation that has a lot of momentum on its back to go through the Senate and Assembly and be signed by the governor.
Now, you have an impressive list of organizations that are supporting this bill, and I'll ask you in a moment maybe articulate a few of them. But I saw a memo of one of the groups I used to work with at Hunger Action Network, which is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, part of the AFL-CIO. And they particularly weighed in their memo about the situation we saw a number of years ago in Puerto Rico, where a lot of these vulture funds were really, you know, quite active and basically trying to force austerity budgets onto Puerto Rico, with many of the private creditors insisting on full debt repayment, which particularly for AFSCME not only would result in a lot of service workers losing their jobs, but also slashing of pension benefits for public retirees. What are some of the situations that countries do face in, you know, trying to deal with these debts and these vulture funds, you know, really trying to extract as much income as possible?
So, you know, these so-called vulture funds, they're predatory hedge funds. There's only a very small group of them. They're not actually domiciled in New York. Many of them don't pay any taxes there in the Cayman Islands. But they buy debt off of what's called the secondary market in New York State. So I know a lot of people who've gone through a medical bankruptcy or had medical challenges get phone calls from a creditor who bought their debt for pennies on the dollar and is trying now to collect in full. So that's essentially what these do, but they do it for on the scale of countries. So they buy a country that's in a crisis. The education system is falling. People are starving. And what they do is they buy the debt that is not worth as much for 2 cents on the dollar, but then try to collect the other 98 cents. So this has been a predatory model that's been very successful from some of these so-called vulture funds because they don't negotiate. They hold out. And what that means, when they hold out, they free ride, so to speak, off our taxes because the U.S. government and international financial institutions offer debt relief to these countries. So we're bailing them out. They're also taking money from the majority of creditors that restructured or tried to get the debt back to profitability. So they're taking from them. But of course, the worst aspect is they're collecting from a country that cannot afford to pay. So
we only have about 90 seconds left. So I'm going to ask you a two-part question. One is I began to write a couple of years ago op-eds about the concept of Jubilee as the world is facing this climate crisis, and the third world countries are the ones that are the victims primarily of climate change, even though it's the industrial global north that created this. So two-part question. One, how does the this bill actually deal with the climate crisis? And second, if people want to weigh in with officials or find out more, and actually I'll mention Assemblymember Fahey from the Capital District is the lead sponsor, at least in the assembly. In the last minute, how can people do that and the climate impact?
Yeah, this is incredibly important on climate, because what's happening with countries in crisis is they're cutting all funds for climate adaptation and mitigation. So when this bill moves forward, it's going to be one of the most important financial instruments to offer aid for countries that need to deal with the climate crisis. It's why so many environmental groups are coming on board during these last weeks to pass the legislation. And, you know, if you want to help, you can go to our website, www.jubileeusa.org, jubileeusa.org. And there you'll find information about the New York campaign. And if you want to be involved, things you can do. Great to be on your show again, Mark, to talk about H2970S47S47.
Well, thank you very much, Eric LeCompte, Jubilee USA Network, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Mark Dunley spoke with Eric LeCompte from Jubilee USA Network, and you can hear more on these issues, especially environmental issues, on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
So at the end of April, two Residence Life staff members at a small Christian university in upstate New York were fired after refusing to remove their pronouns from their email signatures. Elizabeth EP Press reports.
Hi, I'm Shua Wilmot, the former area coordinator at Houghton University.
And I am Reagan Zelaya, the former women's area coordinator at Houghton University.
We were both fired this week.
They were. It's true.
And we'll read to you verbatim parts of the letter that we received that are relevant. So for me, it starts off, you were previously advised that your employment was not being renewed next year.
Reagan, you previously tendered your resignation, advising that you did not intend to return next year.
However, as a result of your continued use of pronouns in your email signature in violation of institutional policy after you had been asked to remove them.
However, as a result of your refusal to remove pronouns in your email signature in violation of institutional policy.
So that's the first reason. For both of us, there were two reasons. The first reason is our use of pronouns in our email signature, which we can share a little bit about why we chose to do that. Keep our pronouns, our cisgendered pronouns, in our email signature. And for those who might not know what that means, for me, it's like, in my case, when you get an email from me, at the bottom, it'll have my sign-off, like earnestly or in gratitude, comma, and then my name, Shua Wilmot, and underneath that, my position, it says area coordinator, and then below that, it says he, him, with like the tall bar, and then it has my email address.
Yeah, we had been, at the beginning of the school year, I had had my pronouns. It said Reagan Zelaya, she, her, she slash her, and then my contact information, my title, that type of stuff. And then we had received an email, I think maybe in October, just institutional-wide saying, you know, for marketing purposes and for branding purposes, we are trying to have a streamlined email signature. And they had given a bunch of different examples, such as, oh, like, you shouldn't have Bible verses, or, you know, crazy fonts, or here's the color scheme, here's the fonts, here's what your email signature should look like for branding purposes and, like, marketing. And so at that point, I had gone through and changed my email signature to match their fonts, colors, sizes, format of how they wanted the information, with the addition of my pronouns. That so it said my name, Reagan Zelaya, she, her, in their fonting or in their font and color branding style. And then I also, which they didn't include in my, they would say that I was being fired because my email signature was not aligned with institutional policy, and they specifically mentioned my pronouns, but they don't mention my meeting link that I had at the bottom, which wasn't institutional policy either. So it just shows like the priority of why,
right,
what was bothering them about my email signature. Because at the end I had a link that says set up a meeting with Reagan, which was not.
It does say like don't have links in there as well. But I also changed my email signature when that came out, and I made it uniform with the new policy, except for where they say that you can put your phone number. In my role, like, I don't post my phone number there. And so where I would put my phone number, I instead put he slash him. But apart from that, and then the meeting link, which is very useful for people in our role that have that in your email signature,
But that
yeah,
wasn't
Yeah, we
an
did
issue.
Make changes. Yeah, and that, of course, was not an issue. Right. So why bother? I've been asked, like, why die on this hill? Well, I'm not going to die, first of all. But I'd say there's, like, four or five main reasons. One of them, let's just talk about the practical element. My name is Shua. It's an unusual name, and it ends with a vowel, A, that is traditionally feminine in many languages. And so if you get an email from me and you don't know who I am, you might not know how to gender me. And I have been mistaken as a woman over email and in person because I have long blonde hair. But I don't mind. I'll say this. Like, I truly don't mind if I'm misgendered. There's nothing wrong with being a woman. But when somebody misgenders me, it sometimes makes them uncomfortable. So let me avoid that professionally by just putting my pronouns in my email signature so you know that you're talking, that you're writing to and writing from a man.
Reagan is also a dual gender name. I know many men and women who have the name Reagan, and so it, from a practicality point, is helpful in the same way to say what my pronouns are. But for me, when I originally had done it, A, it is a pretty standard industry practice.
Yeah, and that's the second reason we should talk about. Yep.
Yeah, to include your pronouns in your email signature. When you go to conferences, I have a lot of students who are involved in manners or other things that go to conferences and have come back and told me, oh yeah, when I was at the conference, like on my name tag, the standard was to have pronouns. And you'll find most places now, it is an industry standard to have pronouns included in your email signature.
There you go. Reason two, it is a professional standard for educators, especially, to have their pronouns in their email signature. And I've had interviews now with probably a dozen different organizations, mostly educational institutions, and almost every professional has their pronouns in their email signature, has their pronouns next to their Zoom name.
Mm-hmm. And as in my interview processes, I've had, they will open the interview with, hi, my name is Reagan Zelaya, my pronouns are she, her.
Yes, yes. And they'll expect that as a professional who they're interviewing, that I say, my name is Shua Wilmot, I use the pronouns he, him. It's how you start a lot of interviews.
So it's important for students who are going out outside of the Houghton context to understand what the expectations are in the industries that they're entering. Is just another reason.
A third reason is that as an educator, especially at a place where many people don't know a lot about gender and sex, I think that it's a great conversation starter to have my pronouns in my email signature. And I will say I've had some great conversations with great students about this topic now, as a result of like this whole controversy, as a result of having my pronouns in my email signature, it was a Lear decision. It has given me the opportunity to educate people on this topic. And I'm an educator, so I want to be able to do that. And a fourth reason is that it marks us as safe people. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, I have a lot of privilege that when people see me and meet me in person, they can say, oh, you look like a woman. I'm going to address you as a woman. And I don't have to worry about that. And something that's a privilege that not everyone has, to be addressed and given the dignity of being called by your name and called by who you are in your heart and your identity. And so for me, it felt like a way that I can show solidarity with the people who don't have that privilege. And it has nothing to do with my personal beliefs or convictions. It is just a way, it's a professional courtesy that I can offer. And it's a way that I can show care and dignity for others without ever having to talk to them or do anything.
That's right. Yeah. My name is Joshua. I do not like to be called Josh. And if you call me Joshua, great, that's my name. If you call me Shua, that's great, that's my preferred nickname. And so calling people by the name that they like to be called, using the pronouns that they like to be called, regardless of what you think about gender and sex, that's just a way to dignify them and humanize them. And I want to say a little more on this topic. I wrote something out just so that I could get the phrase exactly right. So this kind of builds off of what Reagan was saying. For some people, sharing their pronouns means outing themselves every time they share their preferred pronouns. For me, it's not emotional labor to say I'm a man. By normalizing the visibility of pronouns in an email signature, I can play a small role, Reagan can play a small role, in empowering others to also share their pronouns in their email mm-hmm. signature. Thus, it normalizes a less emotionally laborious way for gender-expansive individuals to out themselves. If cis people are putting their pronouns in their email signature, then it becomes a more normal thing. And so when gender-expansive people put their pronouns in their email signature, they can let people know what their pronouns are without exhausting themselves emotionally again and again. And it becomes a normal and accepted thing, which, like I said earlier, it is a normal and professionally expected thing in a lot of cases. So I hope you better understand why we have our pronouns in our email signature, and I hope that you understand that there's value in having pronouns in your email signature.
That was Shua Wilmont and Reagan Zelaya, who were recently fired from the Houghton University, and that report was put together by Elizabeth E.P. Press.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Gabe Cruz Allen.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany. Also streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
While visiting the sanctuary, Barrio Alegria wanted to record some of their work for the radio. Central to their work is creative placemaking.
And in this roundtable, members discuss what it means to them.
Hello, everybody. We are Barrio Alegria visiting the Sanctuary for Independent Media in beautiful, sunny Troy, New York. And one of the main things we do as a nonprofit from Reading, PA is creative placemaking. And we want to talk a little bit more about it. So I pulled up a definition from arts.gov for creative placemaking. It says, creative placemaking integrates arts, culture, and design activities into efforts that strengthen communities. And I'm here with the Barrio Alegria team to see how everybody else feels about that definition.
Hi, I'm English. For me, creative placemaking is holding tangible physical spaces and making them sacred for art personality, for people to feel welcomed wherever they are, just holding physical space that allows you to breathe easily.
My name is Ashley. To me, creative placemaking is using any space. It could be a park, it could be a church, a museum, and with that space, you develop the narrative of nurturing and growing creativity. It could be through visual arts, it could be through music, but the essence of creative placemaking is to develop a place where people can grow in their creativity and inspire more creativity.
Gati, and for me, creative placemaking is creating events, but not just any events. It's creating events with intense meaning behind them. Like, it's, we want to transform places. We want to transform people. We want to build connections, create possibilities, opportunities. It's thinking of every aspect of not only how can we, like, entertain people, but what do they need? What can we bring to them? How can we serve our community?
Hi, I'm Chris. I wanted to touch on what Gati said and also bring it back to what English said about creative placemaking, making people feel safe and giving them a space to be comfortable where they might not be welcome in other spaces that make them feel comfortable. And a lot of that starts from within also. Like Gati said, sometimes it's about making events that make community members feel safe, but we also do creative placemaking from within. At Barrio, we ensure that like all of our fellows feel safe working, make sure they're not overwhelmed with the workload, and we share the workload. And it really just does start from within, because if we transform our fellows, then we can trust that our fellows will go out into the community and transform the community around them poco a poco.
Hi, my name is Fabiola. For me, creative placemaking is kind of holding space for Barrio. We like to do creative placemaking in vacant spots to kind of breathe life back into those areas. That's why, you know, creative placemaking, we like to be creative wherever we hold these spaces.
Hi, my name is Eli, and for me, creative placemaking is a place that you're co-working not just with the artists, you're co-working with the community for creating and open spaces and make they that spaces as all a new experience for everyone. Besides that, is like the support and holding of different artists, different communities, open and make the change for all of them.
Hi, my name is Yuri. Un espacio creativo es un lugar donde tú puedes desarrollar tus habilidades artísticas de la mejor manera. Y es muy importante la creatividad en nosotros, ya que con ella nos ayudamos a desenvolvernos en un futuro, en lugares artísticos, a tener seguridad, tener creatividad.
For me, as Judy said, that creative placemaking is an opportunity for having creativity that is really very important for us in the place that you can develop in the future, have security of yourself in the public.
Hi, my name is Ashley, and I just wanted to add to the idea of safety being part of creative placemaking. I think it's very important in a creative place to give people the freedom to be themselves and to express that freely and to explore what that means.
I think as related to what Chris was saying, creative placemaking is also breathing new life back into spaces that were dead, whether it's from the civic injustices, whether it's dilapidation of old buildings, but seeing something for its inherent beauty and allowing that to shine through by honoring the space, the people, the air around it, and allowing those places to thrive in new ways and reimagining them and saying that there is still this inherent beautiful thing in the creativity and even just the way that we look at it. And just trying to honor and respect what once was, and then just to look at this and say, wow, there's legacy still here. I think that's a really important piece of the creative placemaking and placekeeping, and Barrio does that really well, of honoring people, honoring the process, and then saying, okay, but what can we do with this thing that was unloved and love it again?
And to further what English said, yes, creative placemaking is very, very important, but then it transitions into creative placekeeping, which is arguably even more important than simply making the spaces. And one thing I really love about Barrio is our favorite method of doing creative placekeeping is slowly, for lack of better explanation, training these community members, community artists, community performers to maintain these creative places, to insist that they belong and that they deserve space that they created, and to resist anyone who tries to tell them that they do not have space in their own community. And I love that Barrio does that.
Oh, to add on to that, I would like to say that kind of like what Chris was saying about how not only is creative placemaking important for members of the community or participants, or it's also about the staff. And also for me, it's making people feel like they also belong when they never feel like they did. And I mean that because it's easy to think that people could just go see, for example, an art show. You would think, oh, anyone should feel welcomed at an art show. But you would be surprised how many people go to art events and feel like they weren't welcomed, or feel like they weren't represented in the art, or feel like they weren't heard or seen in anything, even if marketing says otherwise. And like, for example, I don't live near Barrio, but I feel as though I've known them forever, and I feel as though I've lived in Reading for a while because of how these events that we have created have made me feel in a community that wasn't my own, but is starting to feel like my own because of it.
And to just like visualize what Kathy was saying, it's the little things. Like it's like the sliding admission scale for performances or free performances, if we can offer that. It's making sure there's a translator at every event to make sure that everyone can have their voice heard. It's making sure we always have food in our fridge for anybody who unexpectedly just needs a safe space. It really is the little thing. It's seeing somebody who looks like you on an event flyer, so you know that you are welcome, even if you might self-select out, even if you don't have a friend to go with you, and it seems really hard and really scary to go on your own, because it is sometimes to go out on your own to places where you have seen people you know and love who look like you not be allowed in these places. And it's really reassuring to walk into a room scared like to death that you're gonna have to turn right back around when you walk in, and you walk in and you finally see people who look like you. After knocking on 5 other doors, on the 6th door somebody opens and they look like you, and it's really reassuring.
I think it's really beautiful what Chris was alluding to. Like, creative placemaking is brave work. Brave to say there's something missing and I'm going to create it. Brave to say that all people can come here, no matter what the differences are, where there's representation, and seeking representation. Like, hey, there's too many of one face here, and saying, let's change that. Let's get more colorful people. Let's get more loud people. Let's get more of all of the things to create the beautiful space, to create the creativity, because everything that is the same is not creative. And so I would like to empower people to find ways to make creative spaces wherever, however, using whatever, because that is a part of the process. And it's a really beautiful thing what can come out of that when you just take the really big, brave, scary step to say, I will be the person who creates the space, and kind of write that love language to your community or to whomever. And because we all need those things to be inspired to do, just kind of to wake up every day, because that can be hard and scary and very brave. So everyone has the space to be creative, and whatever that looks like, and to create those spaces every day in your life.
You just heard from Barrio Alegría from Reading, Pennsylvania, who visited the sanctuary. You will hear more on this round from this round table around creative placemaking very soon.
May 25th is an international day celebrated worldwide and throughout America to honor the continuing struggles of peoples of Africa and African descent to fight for liberation from racism, colonialism, and neocolonialism. This is a part two of Willie Terry's conversation with December 12th organizer David Daniels.
You know, I want to go on to get actually a little bit more about the history, but I want you to tell, you know, our listeners what the African Liberation Day that you have and consists of, and what's going to happen during that day.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Terry. Yes, on Saturday, May 27th, here in New York City, in the village of Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, we're going to have a program. It's a free program open to all folks in the community. It's going to be held. The location is the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Plaza, a well-known building in central Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. A trains, C trains go there. The exact address, for those who might be considering trying to make it over, is 1368 Fulton Street in Brooklyn, New York. that program, the doors will open at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, that's Eastern time, from 3 p.m. to about 6:30 p.m. And we feel quite humbled that we're actually going to have a few representatives from the permanent missions of a couple different African countries, specifically from the permanent mission of the Republic of Namibia, has confirmed they'll be sending a representative. The permanent mission for the Republic of Cuba, a long-term supporter of African liberation, they will be sending a representative to speak at the program. Ilambe Braff's son, a brilliant young man, Senke Braff, he is a leader of the Ilambe Braff Foundation. He is confirmed to speak as well. And we're fortunate to have some collaboration. One of the local city council, New York City Council representative, Chi Asi, his office is a co-sponsor of that program with the December 12th movement. So it's going to be a fantastic, I think, discussion. There's going to be culture, expression, presentations on that day. And really looking at the theme, Brother Willie, is Africans' war is against poverty and underdevelopment. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the theme for the African Liberation Day. And just if I may, a bit more on that, it far too often, you know, we have other people speaking for us, you know, telling us what our priorities should be, you know, and that we're saying no. For Africans at home and for Africans here in the United States, we have to deal with this issue of poverty that causes so many different issues. So our war, if you will, is one against poverty that's man-made, that's orchestrated, that's very deliberate, and this question of underdevelopment. You know, there's no reason that we can name any country that if you look at all the development of things, you know, filtered water, the ability to have light, you know, 24 hours a day, the ability to mine to your own land, you know, to use satellite, all these things are not available, not because Africans are just born dumb. No, it's a very deliberate game plan and the oppressive hands to keep African countries underdeveloped. Right.
Will the rally or the day be live screen?
You know, that's an excellent question. But with you asking that, we will talk among ourselves, as a matter of fact, as soon as I get off with you, and we will see. I think it's an excellent point, and we can make that happen. Yeah. But I'll just double check with our folks, because I think it's an excellent thing, certainly for people up in your area.
Yeah, a lot of people up here wouldn't be able to come, but, you know, like you say, you know, we like to know what's going on and get some ideas of things that we could do.
Most definitely. So with you asking that, mm-hmm. I will accept that as marching orders.
Okay.
Yes, we can certainly kick that up. And whether if it was over, you know, if we use some of the existing technology, if we did a Facebook, a live stream,
right.
But we can make that happen for sure. Right. And I appreciate that question.
And we would appreciate it too here. Now, just a little bit about the history. I don't want to hold you too long. I know that African Liberation Day in this country has a long history. What's the name? Kwame Ture of the All-African Revolutionary People Party and mm-hmm. the African Liberation Support Committee, two groups that, you know, when I looked at the history, you know, I see their name flowing through it.
Absolutely.
And could you tell me a little something about that?
Yeah, definitely. I can share my understanding, and I think, you know, African Liberation Day, and I think which is why the December 12th movement and others mm-hmm. who continue to push the idea forward, is because there was a time, you know, I was a younger chap, but there was a time, I think particularly in the 70s, where African Liberation Day was a major, right. well-known, you know, annual important coming together of our people. And I want to say 1974, but don't quote me for sure. But I think in about 1974, there was a rather large, massive gathering. And Ilambe Braff was one of those key organizers and producers and speakers of the program, where we put the issue of what was happening back home in Africa on the front page and having our people understand that those connections. So, but just to quickly try to share a little more detail in terms of the African Liberation Support Committee, that when we talk about support, there were leaders, our organization and others, who, when we talk about African countries who were in the heart of fighting for their own independence, their literal independence, it was people who organized, whether it was clothes, emergency drive, collecting clothes, collecting funds, right, and having some of those African leaders who at that point, they were liberation movements. You know, sister, our chairperson, Viola Plummer, as a concrete example, would have some of those leaders come over when they were in the States, in New York, would provide them a place to stay, to re-energize, to strategize, and mobilize, I'm talking significant sums of resources, and to get those resources directly back to support those African liberation movements.
Right.
So yes, there's a very, very rich history for us being connected to those struggles, but that's why we don't see ourselves as doing this because we're into charity work. Absolutely not. That Africa is our home. And so a lot of those African countries, Namibia, you know, as another example comes to mind, got direct support. Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, right, as you know, December 12th movement has had a long history of cooperation.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you about Zimbabwe.
Yes, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. You know, and so, you know, and frankly, you know, we expect, I mean, it has to be a reciprocal relationship, you know, so Zimbabwe going back, you know, on up to the days of its fighting for its liberation and the eventual when they, you know, whipped the behinds of the British. You know, 1979, the Lancaster House Agreement, which we now can summarize, you know, was a problem that was going to rise back up again. But no, a direct relationship of providing support, material support,
right,
you know, not just emotional, material support, on the ground support, coming to working class, poor, struggling Black folk here in the United States and getting them to take a piece from their paychecks, you know, to mobilize and send and organize supplies back home to those countries. And many of those countries, they will tell, they're incredibly grateful and recognize that the role of the December 12th movements, you know, with the S, those kinds of organizations, of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, that Lumbe chaired for a number of years, for helping them reach where we in the United States, where we have to reach.
Yeah, I noticed when I read it, you know, you're right, a lot of organizations participate, I mean, you know, gave direct support in terms of getting funds and different things to those liberation movements.
That was roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry discussing May 25th as African Liberation Day.
There is a new show coming to town. Who Do Love will be playing from June 1 to 11, 2023 at the Capitol Repertory Theater. Andrea Cunliffe speaks with its producer, Jean Remy Monet.
Jean-Remy Monet, founder of the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York and a great friend of the Hudson Mohawk magazine. He's with us today to talk about his new production at Capitol Rep. You're a very busy man right now. And we spoke earlier in the year when you did Top Dog Underdog. I thought it was terrific. And you also introduced me to Michael Lake, a wonderful actor who then I interview on Hudson Mohawk magazine as well.
Okay.
And I know that you've done another play, I think, at Union College.
Yeah, I just closed one Sunday. I directed it for them. It was a Union College production. I've been working with the local colleges the past few years. I work with Siena College, and I directed for University of Albany last November, which is where I met Alex, who was in Top Dog. And this month, last 2 weeks, I had a show directed for Union College, Sweat by Lynn Nottage. And then that one closed this past Sunday.
And now you have another one opening on June the 1st.
Believe it or not what I wanted to do, because the person who was to direct Who Do Love, unfortunately, could not do it the last minute. And I could not find a director right away to direct Who Do Love. because I had already committed to direct Sweat for Union College. And now I ended up directing two shows at the same time. Yes.
Right. I mean, how do you get the energy? How do you manage to direct two shows at the same time?
I mean, I was lucky. It was two plays that I love. I had two great cast and crew and stage manager. And so it made it much easier. It made going to rehearsal, you know, really, really fun. So I think of the positive thing done me being tired. So it was fun driving to Schenectady because I know that I was going to be with some good people. So it was not a problem. Now, if you tell me, how do I keep up with two scripts? Because there are times that I pick the wrong script when I'm looking for act two, scene one in the wrong script.
Oh, right. Okay.
No, literally, that happened. I'm with one play, and then I'm looking for something on scene one. I said, where is that? I know I just saw it. Where is it? Just for 10 minutes later, I realized that this is the wrong script. That's a Union College script. Okay.
Fun. Well, this new production, because you're doing this at Capitol Rep, that's where you're in residence. You're doing a Hoodoo Love, really an interesting piece of theater.
Well, that's a play that's really, by the way, when you say Hoodoo Love, it sounds like you say, who do you love?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll say
no, no, not you, anybody.
Hoodoo Love.
Hoodoo better? As in voodoo.
You can't stop directing.
Oh, exactly.
No, okay, hey, so you've got a new production for Hoodoo Love.
Hoodoo Love, yes.
Which is an American play written by Katori Hall.
It was, yeah, the playwright is Katori Hall. She has so many plays that I want to do, but I'm doing this one. And then one of the plays that I'm doing next season is also by her. Voodoo is a religion. Coming from Haiti, if you're from New Orleans, Louisiana, if you're from certain part of in the United States, you will know what Hoodoo Love is. And I grew up in Haiti. Everybody knows what voodoo is. Not everybody practices it, but everybody knows what voodoo. There is a saying in Haiti that Haiti is 80% Catholic, 10% Baptist, and 10% everything else, and 100% voodoo.
Okay. Well, they're sort of embracing the whole community, isn't it?
Yeah. So everybody knows about voodoo, but not everybody practices it. So I know about voodoo, of course. I don't practice it, but I know about it. Hoodoo Love, it's a play, you know, where people, you may be in love with somebody, and then when you're trying to keep him or her or them for yourself, and sometimes the only way to keep them home with you, keep them to yourself, is to have some voodoo spell. So, yeah, voodoo spell. And that can be good, it can be bad, it can turn really bad, and it can turn really good, you know. You know, you can make people your slave by doing a spell, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, wow. The story said in 1933 in Memphis.
In Memphis, it's about a young woman who's from the cotton field in Mississippi, and she went on a journey to become a blues singer. It's not a musical, but that's her dream, to be a blues singer. And during her journey in Memphis, then she met Ace of Spades, a young man, fell in love with him. But the young man, that's what he does. He's singing, he's performing in every town. He's meeting new women, having babies all over the corner. This time he got his man. That's where Hoodoo Love comes in. And I don't want to say too much.
Is there any singing at all in it?
There is some singing. Yeah, there is some blues singing. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Well, yeah. That's great. Who are your actors? Have you found some wonderful actors again? You certainly have a knack for that.
Almost every show that I do, I have to have at least one new person who've never done this before. And in this show, the young lady who played Tulu, she is a very talented, brand new actress, never been on stage before. She called me. She said that she'd like to come to audition. Then I check her on Facebook. Everybody was so excited for her. Go for it. She came in. And I love that about people. I have to see the passion in your eyes that you really want to do it. You know, even if it's your first time, I'll work with you. And she came in and she is my Tulu. And she's doing great. Her name is Q. That's short for Cubilla Sales. And Ace of Spades is played by Alex Heck, who was your younger brother in Top Dog Underdog.
Oh, it'd be nice to see him again.
Yeah, yep, he's in there. He's Ace of Spades. And then we have another actor that I've worked with a couple of times, very talented, who played a brother, Jib, Preston Edmonds. And then we have the candy lady who played a voodoo lady in the play. Her name is Josie Smith. Can I tell you something else? It's not a secret?
Yes, yes, yes. If it's a true secret.
A true secret, yeah. Josie Smith playing the candy lady, who's the voodoo lady. She is actually a voodoo lady in real life.
Cool. Realism, huh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I don't always cast somebody just because they do something in real life and cast you. That does, you know, you have to be an actor, you know. I know people, sometimes I'm looking for somebody to play a lawyer. People say, oh, I know a lawyer. I say, no, I'm not looking for a lawyer. I'm looking for an actor who can play a lawyer. But Josie is talented. I've worked with her before many times. She's a real voodoo lady, and she's playing my voodoo lady in this play.
Well, now that's tight casting. Absolutely. That sounds
But she's good.
But you know, that's one thing about you. You pick exciting pieces of theater that I don't think are that widely seen, and they have a purpose.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I started a theater company, for many different reasons. Number one thing, I wanted to start the company to bring more diversity, to bring more people of color, specifically Black actors, but in general, more people of color on the local stage, because there wasn't enough of us on the local stage. That's one. Second, I wanted to do work written by Black playwrights, and people up here don't do enough of that. Okay, they're asking me, where do you get your plays, Remy? I said, where do you get your plays? The same place, the same place you get yours. They say, you know, you can get it too. If you're looking for it, if you want it, you'll find it. So I wanted to get to work, not just looking for actors, but looking for, give opportunity to produce plays written by, you know, people of color. Third, I wanted to do work about social injustice, to educate people about our culture, about racism, about our struggle, fighting for equality for all. And those are the main three reasons why I started the theater company. And we are doing really well. We've put a lot of people out there. For example, just this past two shows alone, there's two brand new talented actors that the community can work with. And we've been doing that for every production we've done.
Not only are the issues important, they are just wonderfully entertaining. It's a true theater event.
That's the best way to educate people. Look, I learned most of my English in American history through theater. You know, it's great to learn something while you're having fun. You learn more. People don't realize it. They learn so much stuff on television, bad or good, but, you know, without a book in their hand. Don't get me wrong, I love books, but watching something on stage, you may not realize how much education you're getting, because you're sitting there laughing, watching something, and then, but that's something you know. I'm telling you a story about a culture, about voodoo, and then you didn't go there for that. You never know anything about Haitian voodoo or Louisiana. Now suddenly you learn so much more just by watching a play. Sometimes it could be very serious stuff, but me, knowing me, I always add something in it for you to have fun, whether it's from my music in the play, you know, just make it interesting. And that's what I do. I like to have fun, educate people at the same time.
This has been Andrea Kudla for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, speaking with Jean-Remy Monet of the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York.
And that was coverage of the new production, Who Do Love, playing at the Capitol Repertory Theater from June 1st to 11th. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Gabe Cruz Allen.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey. We want to thank all the volunteers who made today's episode possible. Mark Dunley, Elizabeth E.P. Press, Barrio Alegria, Willie Terry, Andrea Cunliffe, and Gabe Cruz Allen. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a Sanctuary Sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Media Sanctuary, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. We appreciate you listening. Until next time.